Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. The Alabama State Senate passes the most restrictive abortion ban to date, making no exceptions for victims of rape and incest. Alabama lawmakers voted Tuesday to ban virtually all abortions in the state, including for victims of rape and incest, sending the strictest law in the nation to the state's Republican governor, Kay Ivey, who is expected to sign it. The measure permits abortion only when necessary to save a mother's life, an unyielding standard that runs afoul of federal court rulings. What's really at stake here? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my first guest. She's a professor and organizer with the Geneva Women's Assembly, Hannah Dickinson. Hannah, welcome to the Critical Hour.
So happy to be here.
Let's first start. What is the Geneva Women's Assembly?
So the Geneva Women's Assembly is a grassroots, anti-racist, anti-capitalist, feminist organization in rural upstate New York. And our aim in organizing is not just to address the traditional women's issues, although that's getting harder to do, you know, to avoid here, but also bringing a gender lens to struggles around housing, environmental justice, and other issues that impact working people every day.
And so what were your thoughts when you heard either late yesterday or early today of the passage of this bill in Alabama?
It's just cruel, right? So it's a cruel bill that doesn't take science seriously, that doesn't take women's health seriously, and is clearly a calculated political move to attempt to overturn Roe v. Wade, sort of with no concern about how this might impact women and families in Alabama. Really troubling.
When you say that it doesn't take science seriously, what do you mean?
Well, part of what they're really after with this bill is insisting on fetal personhood. Republican Rep. Terry Collins, the bill sponsor, has said, you know, in a very straightforward way, our bill says that the baby in the womb is a person. A reminder to your listeners, this is a bill that would outlaw abortion at any stage of pregnancy, stages when, you know, we're not talking about babies. We're talking about a fetus and even an embryo, right? Just a few cells.
In fact, Alabama Republican Lieutenant Governor Will Ainsworth said in an interview before the vote that the debate was about the idea of personhood and whether a fetus has rights from the outset. And this is really interesting to me since, as I recall, one of the big issues for the Roe court back when Roe v. Wade was decided was not only the right to privacy, which is not explicitly stated in the Constitution, but the concept was constructed based upon other expressed protections in the Bill of Rights. But one of the other big issues that the court grappled over was, when does life begin? And as I recall, they spoke with a number of experts from varying disciplines. They spoke to theologians. They spoke to biologists. They spoke to a lot of different people trying to get a consensus on when does life begin. And their inability to get the consensus to that question is one of the elements that moved them to decide in the manner in which they did. And with that, a fetus is not a person.
That is exactly right. And again, this Alabama bill is pushing things even further, right? They are not talking to scientists or medical professionals. The aim here is clearly a political one. We're not having conversations about even when a fetus might be viable outside the womb, right? No embryo is viable outside the womb, except maybe in a petri dish, right? So that this is, they are not at all concerned about what the science might say here. They're really after setting some legal precedent that is going to produce a whole set of bizarre legal challenges, right? What happens, for example, if for incarcerated women who are pregnant. Are we really going to say that the embryo or fetus that that woman is carrying is a person? Are they? What kinds of rights are they entitled to? Or do they deserve to be incarcerated? Right. So a set of strange legal questions will arise here, in part because there's no meaningful scientific or legal reason to be claiming that a fertilized egg is a person.
What about their just abhorrent inability to even recognize rape and incest and forcing a 11-year-old, a 12-year-old, a 13-year-old girl who is victimized by either a family member or is victimized by someone else and winds up being pregnant, forcing that girl to carry a baby to term outside of any risk to that young girl's life, forcing that young girl to carry that baby to term and then thereby forcing that young girl to live every day haunted by the memory of the horrific act put upon her by the fact she now has a baby that she's got to take care of. Or at least if they put it up for adoption, she knows that there is some child walking around the face of the earth.
That's right. I mean, it's just cruel and reveals that this bill and bills like it are not actually about care for children, right? If lawmakers were really, really concerned about the lives of children here, they would not be forcing 11-year-old girls, as is the case in Ohio, to be carrying babies to term, right? I mean, so on the face of it, right, just shows that, again, this is about playing politics and not about what's good for women and children. But I don't know if your listeners would have seen the sort of spectacle last week on the Senate floor in Alabama as they're yelling at each other about this. And again, what's clearly at stake there is this fetal personhood argument, right? If that's what they want to bring to the Supreme Court, their political calculation is, ooh, we can't make an incest or rape clause because then maybe, we would be murdering babies, right? And so again, science is not on their side, morality is not on their side, and yet they're going to keep trying to push this through.
In fact, to your point about the spectacle on the floor of the Alabama legislature, there were two debates that I found incredibly, incredibly compelling. I do not recall the name of the state assembly person, but it was a woman who stood up and said that this bill is hypocritical in that the Republicans in the state assembly constantly complain about the government being involved in their taxes, about the government mm-hmm. being involved in their homes, about the government encroaching upon their personal, I'm paraphrasing, encroaching upon their personal lives. And then she said, but now you want to inject the government into my womb.
Mm-hmm.
And when she said that, I said, wow, I had not looked at it that way. It might have been the same woman who also then turned to the Republican that she was debating, and she said, have you ever been raped? And he said, no. Have you ever been a victim of incest? And he said, no. And then she asked him a few other questions along that same line, and then she just looked at him and said, well, then how in the world can you even consider understanding what it is you're doing? Because you have never been involved, and because you're a man, you'll never be involved in the depths of this to which you're now trying to legislate. I thought that was also an incredibly compelling argument.
Very compelling. And, for folks that do work with rape and sexual violence survivors, right, we know that one of the things that rape and sexual assault does is take control, right, away from the person who's been assaulted. And here we have a bill that's not about life, right? It's about exercising dominance and control over women and their autonomy, their bodies. And so the cruelty again of saying you've experienced a traumatic experience in which control over your body was taken away from you in an assault, and now, right, just as the legislator said, the government is also going to come in and exert control over your bodily autonomy.
You used the word in your earlier answer, you said forcing. And one of the things that I have always raised in this debate is whether you're pro-life or pro-choice, well, particularly those who argue on the side of pro-life, be as pro-life as you want to be. And God bless you for being pro-life. But who made them the arbiter of how someone else's life should be managed, or what divine entity anointed them to be the determiner and arbiter of how another woman is supposed to manage her life? Again, be as pro-life as you want to be and do everything you want to do to see to it to protect what you consider to be the sanctity of life. But keep that outside of my home and keep that outside of the homes of those who do not subscribe to the same belief system that you do.
I mean, I couldn't agree more. And it seems important to just add into this conversation all of the unequal ways in which we know restricted access to abortion impact poor women and particularly women of color. So already we know it is the case that because abortion has been restricted in a whole number of ways in the U.S., that it is women of means who have historically always been able to access abortion, right? They can fly to another state, for example. And it's poor and working class women who these types of restrictions are going to particularly impact, right? So we're now talking not just about making a very deeply personal choice for another woman. We're also talking about what we know will be a really uneven application of the law when what poor and working class women really need, right, is access to better reproductive health care, access to better support in supporting their family, thinking carefully about how our foster care system and criminal justice system works when it comes to parenting, right? If we really cared about the lives and well-being of the children in this country, those are the kinds of things we would be talking about when we're talking about reproductive justice, right? We wouldn't be separating parents from their children at the border. We would be thoughtful about what happens to incarcerated mothers. But we're not talking about those things. We are instead talking about how do we just layer even more dominance and inequality into the experience of gender in the U.S.?
One of the other elements of this law is sentencing doctors who perform abortions up to 99 years in prison. That is incredibly onerous, and I think could also very well be one of the factors that winds up either moving the Supreme Court to hear this and overturn it, or as it is being anticipated, it will be overturned or stayed in the lower courts and the Supreme Court will decide not to hear it, thereby accomplishing the same result.
Yeah, so a couple issues there. So the first is about what we might expect from the courts, and you're absolutely right. I think we'll likely see this bill overturned in lower courts, and it'll really be up to the Supreme Court about whether this is the case or one of the cases they want to hear when it comes to the question of abortion access in the U.S. And so while I think it's really important to keep our eye on this particular legislation, especially because of the personhood argument they're trying to make and the way in which this bill was actually tailored to be a challenge to Roe v. Wade, we may very well see the Supreme Court erode abortion access and reproductive rights in other ways, whether they do or don't decide to hear this case, This week, in fact, we saw from Clarence Thomas a ruling on a very different case about a very different thing that does suggest that this court, our current Supreme Court, may be taking a different approach to overturning previous decisions.
To precedent and the whole idea of stare decisis, letting the decision stand.
Precisely.
Yes, yes. So
just again, for listeners to know, there are 250 new bills in 51 states over the last few years that have been passed. And so what it is the Supreme Court ends up hearing, we'll see. But it is clear it's a full court press to challenge Roe v. Wade and abortion access in the U.S.
And most of those laws have been passed in the South and in the Midwest of this country. One of the things that's also very hypocritical to me, particularly as this relates to Alabama, has to do with capital punishment, with the death penalty. And so if these folks in Alabama are so self-righteous and are so wedded to and have to protect the sanctity of life, capital punishment in Alabama has the highest per capita death penalty rate in this country. And in some years, the Alabama courts have imposed more death sentences than the state of Texas, and that's a state that has a population five times as large as Alabama. So, again, it's just hypocrisy prima facie, all over its face.
All over its face. And I think, the only explanation I come up with at this point, right, is they are after two things. I mean, one is going after abortion is a big fundraiser. It gets people out to vote, and it's one of the ways that Republicans who might otherwise, and some Democrats, frankly, who might otherwise not be popular, can sort of show off their conservative bona fides. So, right, there's that political work going on here. But again, I think we're talking about an attempt to reorient the U.S. to a place where gender hierarchies and patriarchy is reinforced, where the government is fine saying we will dominate, control the bodily autonomy of women, right? And in certain respect, we can almost see the death penalty that way too, right? A small number of people, mostly white folks, mostly men, right, saying, it's up to us. We get to decide who lives and dies and under what circumstances.
Final point here. A lot of people will look at polling and look at the polling question about pro-life versus pro-choice. And those polls, they'll shift, some of it having to do with whether or not the issue is in the news. But you'll see 47, 43, 40, 45, the numbers will vary to a great degree. And so you'll have a lot of pro-life people stating, oh, the public overwhelmingly is pro-life. And there are polls that will support that position. But here's the thing. It's not about pro-life or pro-choice, because when you ask the real question about support for or opposition to Roe v. Wade, public opinion on that question has been stable for decades. In fact, the constituency for overturning Roe has gradually eroded, and the country is now anywhere from about 70% to 75% in favor of upholding Roe v. Wade. That is the real question. The question is not pro-choice or pro-life. The question is, where do you stand on a woman's right to choose?
That is exactly right. And I will just say, I think this is a place where, those of us who want to take a progressive approach to women's issues, need to start using some better language. We're talking about reproductive justice here. It's
correct.
Not just about pro-choice, right? We are talking about wanting a society in which women can choose to have a child or not under the circumstances that they want to with support. And that's what we need to be after here, not this narrow pro-life versus pro-choice type decision.
Hannah Dickinson, professor and organizer with the Geneva Women's Assembly, thank you so much for your time today. Greatly appreciate your contribution to the Critical Hour, and I look forward to having you back.
I look forward to that, too.
Thank you.
Nice talking to you. All right.
Thank you. All right, folks, you're listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. The city of San Francisco bans facial recognition technology. San Francisco, long at the heart of the technology revolution, took a stand against potential abuse yesterday by banning the use of facial recognition software by the police and other agencies. The action, which came in a 8-to-1 vote by the Board of Supervisors, makes San Francisco the first major city to block a tool that many police forces are turning to in the search for both small-time criminal suspects and perpetrators of mass carnage. What's really at stake here, and why is this technology that so many people have been convinced is keeping us safe, why is this an issue? Well, for insight, we turn to my next guest. She is the CARE, Council on American Islamic Relations, Government Relations Coordinator in the San Francisco Bay Area, Ms. Samina Usman. Ms. Usman, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
So we've been told, whether you're in London or whether you're in France, I think in China, that this facial recognition technology is being employed. You basically can't step out onto a public street without a camera capturing your image and your image being processed through a database. We've been told that this is key in the fight against terror and keeping us safe. San Francisco thinks otherwise. Why?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, in the U.S., we have our First Amendment and our Fourth Amendment rights. We have the right to privacy. And having such an invasive type of technology, such as facial recognition, is definitely invasive. And it actually it has a chilling effect on one's First Amendment rights. I mean, you know, would people feel comfortable going out to a protest or going to their place of worship if they know that they're going to be tracked and monitored at all times using this type of facial recognition software? I think people might shy away from doing such activities if this type of technology is implemented with our police.
So is it fair to say that the issue is not the technology, the issue is how the government will employ and is employing the technology, or is it both?
I think it's all the above and then some. I mean, I think it really goes to our values. I mean, again, you know, are we going to be standing by our Fourth Amendment right to privacy? And I don't believe that in implementing facial recognition technology, will reflect that. But in addition, this type of technology is really problematic as it is, given the fact that there are numerous false positives. False positive matches, with this technology. Studies have shown, actually the New York Times published a report saying that, the lighter the skin, the more accurate the technology is. The darker the skin you have, then you see a lot of these false matches. And actually the with African American women, there's 35% false positive matching with other folks. So that's really problematic, because if police is going to be using this type of technology and will stop people with saying that, oh, hey, this is a criminal, if this will have a really negative impact on people of color because of these false positive matches.
There's an article here in Vox, facial recognition systems that may be beyond fixing. Facial recognition technology is pretty good at identifying white people, but it's notoriously bad at recognizing black faces. That can produce very offensive consequences, like when Google's image recognition system labeled African Americans as gorillas in 2015. But given that this tech is now used in police surveillance, which disproportionately targets people of color, maybe we don't want this technology being implemented. So if you start with a bias of racial profiling to begin with, and then you layer on top of that technology that has been proven to be very poor at identifying people of color, you are subjecting people of color in this country to an even more extreme, what I will call, world of hurt.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. This is clearly a technology that is inaccurate and could lead to cases of people getting targeted. And as you already mentioned, we already have problems with police use of force against, black and brown communities. And to have this added layer with these false positives is incredibly dangerous.
There is also, according to this Vox article, facial recognition technology has also caused problems for transgender people. For example, some trans Uber drivers have had their accounts suspended because the company uses a facial recognition system as a built-in security feature, and the system is bad at identifying the faces of people who are in the process of transitioning. Getting kicked off the app costs the drivers fares and, in many instances, costs them their job. So some would say on the side of the artificial intelligence companies that are developing the software, these are just the processes that we have to go through as we perfect the technology. But perfecting the technology at the expense of specific groups and very large groups of people, and in instances that could result in the death or the incarceration of these people, is unacceptable.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, absolutely. And so, again, using such ineffective technology or inaccurate technology, it could cost people's lives. So, and there was another case where, of course, unfortunately, with the recent bombings in Sri Lanka, there was a woman from the United States who was falsely identified as one of the perpetrators of the horrific bombing that happened in Sri Lanka. So again, you have families people that could be targeted based on these false matches, and it could have some dire, consequences because of that. But one thing I wanted to mention is that in addition to this facial recognition ban, San Francisco passed a stop secret surveillance ordinance. So this is part of the total package, which is legislation that has, like the Bay Area has been passing these surveillance ordinances, which basically say that in order to acquire any surveillance technology, there needs to be a public process before the Board of Supervisors and the community, so that people will be able to weigh in whether or not we need this type of new surveillance technology, whether it's worth the cost, whether it's worth our privacy being violated, or whether it be if there's any need for this. In addition, it creates a use policy on how the surveillance equipment that we already have should be used. So again, these are efforts in order to protect our community, protect our civil rights, and to make sure that we're keeping our community safe.
One of the elements of that movement to bring surveillance under community control is the government should never acquire or deploy surveillance technology without community input and clear systems of oversight. That is incredibly clear. I think that's almost like a duh kind of position. But unfortunately, again, the people in this country have been sold this bill of goods about the terrorist threat and the war on terror, and that they will sacrifice their civil liberties for security. and they'll wind up with neither.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that's, you know, we as you mentioned, I mean, we are living in this climate of fear, and people are, you know, but we should not be sacrificing our civil liberties and our civil rights. And it actually doesn't even keep our community safer, because again, if communities are going to feel more and more distrustful of police, which they have every right to be given, the track record, it does not keep our community safer if you have this, you know, more of a reason to distrust law enforcement. So if you have this public process, it allows for community. I'll give you an example. San Jose, this is a few years ago, they had acquired a drone, and this was a line item that was just kind of hidden in the budget process. And nobody would have known had it not been for some community groups that just were looking through the budget and found out that, hey, the police department is acquiring a drone. And we were able to bring it out into the public and say, hey, this is why do we need a drone? What is it going to be used for? Are they going to be deploying more drones? What is the and so we were able to have that public process. But we shouldn't have the case where communities have to, you know, scour through all of the budget in order to find out what our law enforcement is planning to acquire. This should be a public process from the outset, and that's why Santa Clara County had passed the first ever surveillance ordinance in the country, and then that was the first county, and then Berkeley was the first city to pass it as well in the country.
Let me read two paragraphs from the San Francisco ordinance, which I think should get a lot more attention. This ordinance promotes public safety by creating a democratic process to ensure transparency and accountability. The law is straightforward. If a city department wants to acquire surveillance technology, the ordinance requires that there be public notice, clear use policies, and a vote by the Board of Supervisors. When unaccountable surveillance systems proliferate in our neighborhoods, it puts people's lives in danger and threatens civil rights. High-tech surveillance can be easily abused. If left unchecked, these systems can enable digital profiling, stifle the speech of activists, and increase the chances that people, especially low-income residents and people of color, will become entangled with the police and put in life-threatening situations. That's pretty straightforward, and I would have a real hard time taking issue with anything in that statement.
And what's interesting is that when you do actually explain the ordinance to law enforcement or to chiefs of police, they actually say, hey, you know, we need an ordinance like this. This is great. I want to know how long am I supposed to be keeping this data for? Am I going to be keeping it for a few months, or am I going to keep it for a never ending? Because data, you know, keeping that data costs money. You know, people, so like in Davis, the chief of police of Davis became one of our biggest proponents of this surveillance ordinance. So, you know, when we've worked with chiefs of police, they've actually been like, oh, you know, this is actually a good thing. I mean, I can't say that all chiefs of police might feel the same way, but, you know, some of the ones that we've worked with have been our proponents of this ordinance. But one of the reasons why having such an ordinance is important to the Muslim community is because we've actually seen surveillance of our community, I mean, you know, time and time again. But one of the biggest cases was with the New York Police Department, where they had a whole program in order to surveil the Muslim community, having their security cameras pointed towards mosques, towards businesses owned by Muslims, towards, you know, where certain leaders had lived. And this whole active surveillance program did not produce a single terrorist at all. And what it did was that it made the community scared of calling law enforcement, scared of working with law enforcement. And so again, this does not make our community safe. And that's why we need to have ordinances in place in order to know what is our law enforcement doing in terms of, you know, what type of surveillance equipment that they have and how they're using it.
You know, using the rationale that the New York City police used to surveil the Muslim community, if they applied that same rationale to the community where the young man from Poway, California, who shot up the synagogue, or the older guy in Pittsburgh who shot up the synagogue, or Dylan Roof, who shot up Mother Emanuel Church, or the guy who burned the three churches in Louisiana, if they use the same rationale that they're using to surveil Muslim communities, and they employed that same rationale and technology in white communities, I wonder what they'd find.
And that's the thing. I mean, I'm not going to say that we should be profiling white people.
No, not at all.
I know you're not saying that either. But I'm saying that, you know, just with the same logic as we should not be profiling, you know, white communities or any other specific, you know, ethnic group, almost like expecting them to do something, you know, we should not be doing that for black and brown communities or the Muslim community as well. You know, these type of investigations should only be if there's a probable cause, not because they are associated with any particular group.
Wow, that sounds a lot like the Bill of Rights you're referring to. Huh, who would have thought? It's funny. It's funny you mentioned Davis. I'm from Sacramento, and I went to law school at UC Davis. And so it doesn't surprise me that the chief of police of Davis would be a supporter of your position. Final question to you: does it say anything that this is taking place in, that these actions are taking place in, I think you said, Berkeley and San Francisco, since this is really the heart of Silicon Valley?
So we've actually passed it in seven jurisdictions in the Bay Area: Berkeley, Oakland, San Francisco, Palo Alto, Santa Clara County. Yeah, Santa Clara County, and then and also the BART Authority has actually passed it as well, and then of course in Davis. So
for those who don't know, BART is Bay Area Rapid Transit. That's the subway system in San Francisco.
Absolutely. So, yeah, so, you know, to have Silicon Valley, you know, the hub of this type of technology, making a strong statement to stand with our First Amendment rights, with our Fourth Amendment rights, it definitely does send a strong message that we need to have these type of use policies in place, that we do need to reconsider how we're going to be using the technology and how, what type of an effect it's going to have on communities. And, you know, what they say, I mean, I'm biased, what happens in California spreads to the rest of the country. So we're definitely hoping that that will be the case. But especially for us to be in the Bay Area, it definitely, you know, brings up these questions of our privacy and of our civil rights and how we really need to make sure that we protect that.
Ms. Samina Usman from CARE, the Council on American-Islamic Relations. She is the Government Relations Coordinator in the San Francisco Bay Area. Thank you so much for your time, so much for your contribution to the Critical Hour. Look forward to having you back.
Thank you so much. You take care.
All right, folks, you are listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, the U.S. orders non-emergency government employees to leave Iraq while the Trump administration considers responses to potential Iranian attacks, including a troop increase. And as always, folks, be wary of false flag operations. We talked about this on Monday, and the issues continue to escalate. What's going on here? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's a Washington author and investigative reporter. He is the editor of the Deep State Blog, which can be found at www.deepstateblog.org. He writes about the power and influence of secret intelligence agencies in national and international affairs. Jefferson Morley, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thanks for having me, Wilmer. Lots to talk about.
Yeah, as I said to you as we were coming on board here, I said I was looking forward to having you back, but I didn't think I was going to have you back 2 days later. But the Trump administration just seems hell-bent on having you and I continue to talk.
Yeah, well, they're pushing on all fronts. So I think that's what we've seen in the last couple of days is you had the announcement, you've got the president talking about this, you've got news reports. You've got the Central Command and British commander talking about this. So a lot is happening. I think, you know, it's hard to tell exactly what's going on or where this is going, but we're seeing a lot more. And this is this is the Trump campaign of, quote unquote, maximum pressure to harass or provoke a with Iran. So people are probably hearing a lot of these headlines. I think one important thing to understand happened yesterday, which is the one of the British commanders, you know, that's an allied force in Iraq.
Yes.
And the leading British commander said, we have not seen anything in the behavior of Iranian forces in Syria and Iraq that would indicate that they are on any different footing than they were before. A very strong statement indicating that, at least in the theater that this officer was looking at, and he's one of the highest ranking officers in the region, there is no threat. The Central Command is...
Let me get to that point in just a second.
Okay.
Because that's a very key point, and I wanted to use that as part of this. According to the Washington Post, the State Department today ordered all non-emergency U.S. government employees to leave Iraq amid soaring tensions with Iran, which backs proxy forces there. This is according to the Washington Post. It said in a statement that the announcement affects both U.S. Embassy in the capital of Baghdad as well as the consulate in Erbil. A couple of things. First, the use of the phrase amid soaring tensions with Iran and then the use of the term proxy forces, because amid soaring tensions with Iran, it's the United States that is fanning these flames and raising the levels of tension. But the Washington
Right.
Post makes it seem as though this is just some type of natural response between the two countries.
Yes, that's definitely what's going on. It reminds me a little bit of when I was a kid and I was fighting with my brother. And I would complain. I would go to her and I'd say, Mom, and she'd say, I know the story. It all
right.
started when he hit you back, right? And that's what the Trump administration is trying to do. They're trying to provoke the situation where Iran hits the United States for some reason. So this threatening language, it all comes from the United States side. You know, Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran, came out yesterday with a very mild statement. He said, we're aware of what the United States is doing. There's not going to be a war because we don't want war and they don't want war. So I think the Iranians think that the Trump administration is bluffing. And they're not on a war footing and they're not making threatening statements about anybody in the United States. The threat, the tension, are all being generated by the Trump administration.
What about the line in the same story? Iraq is backing proxy forces there. I've heard that. I was listening to the news today. That term continues to be used as though Iran is going around the region and paying people to wreak havoc. My point there was, well, it really depends on which side of the equation you want to consider to be just, rational, and fair.
Well, I mean, look, the United States did Iran a huge favor by destroying Saddam Hussein's regime. Saddam Hussein was the one with U.S. backing who had attacked Iran. So now that Iran has a more open political system, Iran has benefited. And when we talk about proxy forces, you know what that means? That means they support political parties in Iraq that are, you know, that are supportive of Iranians. And remember, these two countries are neighbors. You know, this is like the United States and Canada. I mean, these are two like-minded countries with a majority of Shia Muslims in both countries. And so you know, pilgrims go from Iran to Iraq and from Iraq to Iran all the time. There's business, there's commerce, there's tourism. So when they say proxy forces, it sounds very sinister, but in fact, it's the normal relations between two countries that are neighbors. And so they're trying to turn this into something sinister. Now, are they pro-American? No, they're not. They don't want their country occupied by U.S. troops. So this, the forces that Iran supports in Iraq are saying, you know, the U.S. should leave. But they're not, they haven't attacked those forces. It's a fairly democratic system. And so it's just another place where the Trump administration kind of twists the reality to make it sound much more ominous than it is in order to drive up this threat, in order to drive up the, you know, people's fear, oh, somehow we're under attack from the big bad Iranians. And it's really a phantom. It's a phantom threat. It's not a real threat.
You asked the question, are they pro-American? And the answer is no. But it also, I think, is very important to be clear, they're not anti-American either. When I was in Iran, I was amazed at the number of people that said to me, we don't have any problem with you. It's your government and the fact that you guys won't leave us alone. That's the problem that we have. We have a problem with American intervention in our country.
Yeah. And in fact, you know, culturally, Iranians are the most pro, probably the most pro-American country in the region. If you take out the hostility between the two governments,
right.
Yeah, the Iranians, and the figures back it up. I think before Trump put in his Muslim ban, there were several thousand Iranian students coming here and studying in the United States. I mean, it wasn't completely open, but yeah, you know, Iranians admire America. They want their country to be more open. They have a religious fundamentalist government. A lot of people don't like that, and they look more to a country like the United States that has freedom of religion and doesn't have a established state religion. So we are alienating a very pro-American country with this bullying atmosphere, this bullying attitude that tries to provoke a confrontation and make them look bad.
Now let's get to your point. According to The Guardian, as well as other sources such as The Independent and other papers, the top British general in the U.S.-led coalition against ISIS, Major General Christopher Gaika, who is a deputy commander of Operation Inherent Resolve, the coalition conducting counter-terrorist operations against ISIS in Iraq and Syria, has said there is no increased threat from Iranian-backed forces in Iraq or Syria, directly contradicting U.S. assertions to justify a military buildup in the region. And hours later, his assessment was disavowed by U.S. Central Command in an extraordinary rebuke of an allied senior officer.
Right.
And
that's so telling, because why would a military commander in his position like not talk about a threat? If there was a threat, why wouldn't he talk about it? The fact that he said there's no threat, that it's a highly credible statement, because that's not something that anybody in his position, you know, would talk about if it wasn't true, right? So now they're trying to, you know, overrule him or say, you know, he doesn't know what he's talking about. What, he's the second in command of the whole operation. How do you say he doesn't know what he's talking about? So this is what's going on, is this kind of psychological warfare, beating the war drums, the warmongering, really. I mean, this is, you know, that phrase that sounds very strong, warmonger. But that's what they're doing. They're warmongering to, you know, create some conflict between the United States and Iran. And, you know, it's not there. You know, I always ask people, how many Americans have been killed by Iranian-born terrorists in the last 20 years? And the answer is zero. There's no threat. Now, if we get into a war and we attack them, you know, then there will be a threat and it will be a self-fulfilling prophecy. This is the problem. This is really the big problem about what's disturbing that's going on now, is John Bolton has a long history of misreading intelligence. He was very involved in the invasion of Iraq. and the false story that there were weapons of mass destruction there. He's determined to impose regime change on Iran. And we can be sure that these intelligence statements that they're putting out now are false, or there's no reason to trust them, given the record of John Bolton.
Well, also, and this is from the Washington Post, the Trump administration has accused Iran of supporting imminent attacks on U.S. personnel in the region, but has provided neither details nor evidence. So another reason beyond the fact that John Bolton is the boy who cried wolf, they're not giving us any evidence to support the position.
Exactly, exactly. So what we have here is a campaign to drum up conflict where there is none and create a war where there need not be war, against a country that we need not be enemies with. It's really crazy and disturbing. And, you know, the problem is that people see these headlines, you know, proxy forces, you know, and it's like, no, you know, it's a misrepresentation. The New York Times had a story the other day saying, you know, U.S. officials are worried about these threats as in case Iran resumes working on nuclear weapons. In fact, Iran is not working on nuclear weapons. The CIA has confirmed that they are in compliance with the Iran nuclear deal. And so even the New York Times in their lead story has a factually misleading statement that makes Iran look bad, worse than it is. That's the atmosphere that we're in. That's why this is so disturbing.
And that takes us to Whitney Webb's story in Mint Press, History's Dire Warning, Beware, False Flag Trigger for Long-Sought War with Iran. With the beat of Washington's war drums continuing to grow, particularly following the Monday revelation of a government plan to send as many as 120,000 troops to counter Iran, the threat of an accidental provocation or a false flag is also becoming increasingly likely. As Mint Press reported, the possibility of an accident, and that's in quotes, leading to open conflict between the U.S. and Iran is now being openly stated by top European officials such as U.K. Foreign Minister Jeremy Hunt, following meetings with noted Iran hawk and current Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. They're not fooling anybody.
Yeah, yeah. I noticed, too, a little detail in the Israeli press. You know, we had these supposed attacks on a couple of Saudi oil tankers in the
right.
Persian Gulf by drones. And people are saying, oh, well, you know, that must have been Iran. In fact, the story now is that out of Israel is Israeli intelligence officials informed the U.S. before this attack happened that something was coming. Now, that's not proof that it's a false flag operation, but it should raise our antennae to say there's a very real possibility there, and any attribution of that attack, any quick attribution of that attack to Iranian forces is completely unwarranted. Think how easy it would be. You know, there's probably teenagers who could program a drone and attach a digital signature to that drone from another source and say, look, you know, here's proof that Morley sent this drone into our ship. It would be very easy to do. I mean, because with a drone, there's no person involved, right? So you could blame it on anybody. And these reports are now coming, and they're coming faster and faster. So they're trying to drum up this war to make something happen soon.
You know, you talk about assigning a digital signal. That sounds an awful lot like, I think it's called Operation or Project Marble, which came out of Vault 7 from the WikiLeaks release, where the NSA has designed software to make voting hacking appear as though it's coming from foreign countries. So,
right.
I don't think I'm going too far afield when you use the term assigned digital footprint or signature. That can be done. It's not that hard to do. And the United States government has already developed the technology to do that.
Yes, it would be very simple to do technically. So so I think that, you know, the author is right to beware of, the possibility of false flag operations. Given the record of these people in Iraq, in Iran, more recently, there's no reason to trust anything that they say and to take it at face value. Any such claims have to be independently confirmed. And the fact is, none of them have been this week. The report of threats against U.S. individuals, not confirmed. The report of Iranian involvement in the attack on the tankers, not confirmed. So in this warmongering type environment, we've got to be very careful.
And I was just sitting here thinking, Gulf of Tonkin, maritime. Sinking of the Maine, maritime. The most recent conflict in the Persian Gulf, maritime. Do people see a pattern here? That when you want to have these false flag operations, a lot of times they happen at sea.
Right, because at sea there's no bystanders, there's no witnesses. So it's much easier to fake something if something's happened offshore, right? Because it's not like there's a crowd there who can say, oh, you know, this happened or that happened. And you're exactly right. That's why these maritime attacks figure in provocative incidents like the ones that you just named.
And here's one more thought or one more element for people to think about. Back when the U.S. soldiers were captured by the Iranian Navy, they were held, I think, for 24 hours, and then they were released. And remember, folks, it was really the fact that the U.S. Navy folks had used the wrong waypoint as their marker, and they went into Iranian water, and the Iranians did what they were supposed to do. They went and captured the invading force. They didn't harm anybody, and they released them within 24 hours.
Right. And the difference between then and now is, at least then, we had a friendly relationship, but we had a civil relationship where people could get on the phone and say, look, we want those guys back. The Iranians could say, okay, they were in our waters. We're going to give them back to you. And the whole thing could be resolved without incident, without offense, without harming anyone. We're not really in that situation now. Nobody in Iran is going to make that phone call and say, hey, I can call somebody in Washington and we can resolve this and so that we don't have a problem here. We don't have that now. And that's why people are talking about the possibility of an accident, quote unquote, because the Trump administration is creating the environment where accidents can happen. And the Iranians are not creating the environment where the accidents can happen. It's really all on the American side.
And we'll get out with this. When you create an environment for an accident, it's not an accident.
Exactly. Jefferson
Morley, deepstateblog.org, deepstateblog.org. Thank you so much. Look forward to having you back. Might even be
Thank
tomorrow.
Thank you, Wilmer. Thanks
man.
Me. Take care.
All right. Okay. All right, folks. Well, you have been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.